Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's great to have you with us today. And we begin today in federal court in Baltimore, where the corruption trial of two police officers is in closing arguments. We've covered this trial before. The cops of the Gun Trace Task Force. These, you might remember, are the men allegedly involved in seizing drugs and guns, sending innocent people to jail, robbing civilians.
They would pop open a door in order to see who would run. And then they would run after that person, they would tackle him, and then they would search him. Drugs would go to the sergeant, in which he would then resell. And the money was then split up between all of the officers that were working that day. The sergeant of the unit would say that Hondas and Acuras are usually driven by what he would call dope boys. And so they would pull them over for no reason at all other than the car they were driving. Sneak and peeks. They would gain entry into homes before they would get a warrant to see if there was anything in the house worth stealing.
That's Brian Kubler, reporter for ABC affiliate WMAR-TV in Baltimore, describing just some of what Baltimore officers testified to in this trial. Shakedowns, robberies, theft of evidence, even carrying BB guns to plant on suspects if they were shot. It's become one of the biggest, certainly one of the most shocking police corruption scandals in U.S. history, and one that may have tainted up to 3,000 criminal cases, according to the Public Defender's Office. Six officers have already pleaded guilty in this case. Jane Miller has been following it all. She's an investigative reporter for WBAL-TV, and she's been covering the trial from the courtroom. Jane, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. Jane, today the court hears closing arguments before this case is sent to the jury. What are the charges against these two officers, Detectives Marcus Taylor and Daniel Hursel, the ones on trial here?
The charges center on a racketeering conspiracy that involved the crimes of robbery, robbery with a gun, extortion, overtime fraud, and obviously then the charges that involve betrayal of public trust. But this is a racketeering conspiracy that alleges that these officers use the power that they are granted as police officers to target people, steal from them, take their money, take their drugs, resell them for their own profit.
And Jane, we mentioned some of the shocking testimony over the last several weeks, the robberies, the thefts, framing of witnesses, shaking down.
Shocking to some.
Shocking to some. And we're going to hear in a moment from somebody in Baltimore for whom a lot of this testimony was not shocking, a public defender. That's coming up in a couple minutes. But there was some new testimony, Jane, about Detective Sean Souter, who was killed right before he was set to testify several months ago. What have we learned?
Well, Mamadou Gando was the fourth convicted police officer who was a member of the task force to testify, and he testified on Monday. Former Detective Gando testified that back in 2008 and 2009, when he was in a specialized unit, he and other officers, including former homicide detective Sean Souter, stole money from people. This was the first time since the death of Sean Souter that he has been implicated in the allegations of the Gun Trace Task Force. To this point, he was described as essentially an innocent bystander. Clueless, he was described in one indictment. He did work with these individuals over a number of years in these plainclothes units before moving to homicide.
And Sean Souter killed right before he was going to testify, and that murder, that homicide,
he was found fatally shot in West Baltimore on November 15th. On November 16th, he was to testify before the federal grand jury involving the corruption case.
And that,
from the beginning of the death of Sean Souter, there was an opinion among some investigators that it was not homicide, but a self-inflicted wound. I have reported that according to sources who are familiar with former Detective Souter in the recent months before his death, that he was showing some concern, even to the extent of some use the word distraught, about his upcoming testimony because he was concerned that he was going to be outed. We will never know what was in his mind on November 15th. There was no note that we know of. But certainly the revelations that came from former Detective Gando on Monday of this week cast whole new chapters in the case of Sean Souter.
Jane, we're talking about eight officers here, six who've pled guilty, two on trial now. But how far back does all of this go?
It's a real mistake to look at this case as a recent case. It was recently indicted in March of 2017. But as the case has gone on through evidence and testimony, it is very clear that these crimes did not start in 2014, as is charged in the indictments. These crimes stretch back to the mid-2000s at least. And the testimony and the additional evidence that has come forward exposes not just specific instances, but a real culture in the police department, in the Baltimore Police Department, that had higher-ups looking the other way, that had lots of rules being played fast and loose, and just flat-out criminal conduct under the shield of a police badge, subpoena power, search warrants, and a gun.
Jane Miller for WBAL-TV in Baltimore. Jane, thank you.
Thank you.
The corruption revealed in the Gun Trace Task Force trial in Baltimore came as no surprise to my next guest. Catherine Frey Balter is a former public defender in the Federal District of Maryland. She's now a law professor and a freelance writer, but in the past, she's represented hundreds of Baltimore's accused. Frey Balter says she has lots of cases where clients' federal indictments were based entirely on an officer's uncorroborated accounts, and that many of her clients spoke out about mistreatment, but no one listened.
You know, for too long in the halls of justice and in the courts of public opinion, there has been this presumption that the officer's word is sacrosanct, and the police word was too often uncorroborated and, worse, couldn't be corroborated. So what we had and what we will still have, unless there are changes, is the accused word versus the officer's word. And it just goes to the heart of our criminal justice system. How can we even begin to quantify what this does to a person? I mean, just think what it would be like to be locked up on false charges. It's the greatest deprivation imaginable. It's a categorical denial of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And how can that ever be compensated for?
Well, one thing you write about is the notion that this kind of corruption, these false statements, planting evidence, all of the things we saw in the Gun Trace Task Force trial aren't limited to what the police chief described as a few bad apples. That's what he said. This is isolated. It's a small group of officers in Baltimore who were doing this. There's no systemic problem in Baltimore. And I don't think you buy it.
I don't. No one can say or should say with any confidence how far the rot goes. And it would be irresponsible to reflexively think that the line is drawn as narrowly as to these few charged officers. You know, we have decades of self-reports to counsel. There's volumes upon volumes of citizen complaints. Just 2 weeks ago in Baltimore City, an officer unrelated to the Gun Trace Task Force was indicted by a Baltimore City grand jury on charges including fabricating evidence. Just last night, I saw in the Baltimore Sun that during the course of the federal trial, 12 additional officers have been implicated in wrongdoing. Now, those accusations were made by officers and, I believe, one citizen who were testifying in this trial, and those officers are indeed have been indicted and have pleaded guilty. And there have been no findings with respect to those additional 12 people. But nonetheless, this is what we have. And that's why I think no one can or should say with any confidence that this is limited to a few bad apples. So we have to question, probe, and listen just in terms of going forward.
Well, you lay a serious charge as well in an editorial that I read by you that the riots that the nation watched after the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore lay at the feet of the Baltimore police. Why did you say that?
Let me give you the causal chain. It goes like this. One, looters stole from pharmacies and methadone clinics during the 2015 Freddie Gray riots as the world watched, as the country watched. Two, the officers confronted the looters and seized the stolen goods, the stolen drugs. So far, so good, right? But then three, instead of removing the drugs from the streets, as they are paid and sworn to do, the officers themselves, testimony revealed, the officers themselves engaged in a pervasive pattern of reselling, and they resold those very looted drugs to our city residents. While not relevant to the causal chain, but worth mention, the testimony revealed that during the course of the officer's enterprise, they profited in over $1 million from these sales. So fourth in the causal chain, the police department made an official statement blaming the looted drugs for the post-riot spike in crime. So I think the take-home we have here is that officers that we paid and trusted to keep us safe have been profiting from infusing our city, our community, with drugs, the very drugs which were blamed for the post-riot spike in crime. So our officers are the very drug dealers that they are entrusted to take off the streets. And in their dealing to those drugs to city residents, the infusion led, according to the Baltimore City Police Department, not me, to the spike in crime after the riots.
Well, Ms. Freibalter, you're asking, it seems to me, people to draw a direct connection from the disturbing and shocking testimony that we've seen in this trial over the last several days, weeks, and the guilty pleas over the last several months, to draw a line right from that to broad problems of police corruption or even the broad problem of police brutality that the country's been fixated on for the last few years. Do you think that the country will do that? Will the country presume this is an isolated incident in Baltimore and, as Chief Sousa said, a few bad apples? Or do you think America will start to take a broader lesson here?
We can only hope that America will draw the broader lesson. This corruption that we're seeing in trial is the price that we've paid for not listening. You know, the Black Lives Matter movement has been at the forefront. People of color in the front line have been sharing their experiences in courtrooms and in our streets. And all of these things show us why we must listen. I hope that this trial gets people to put themselves in the shoes of those who have been silenced for too long. You know, I'm sympathetic that if you're not a person of color, it's so hard to understand. But we need to understand what it's like to suffer the daily indignity of police misconduct. If you live in those neighborhoods, this has likely happened to you. You've suffered the indignity of police misconduct. If it hasn't happened to you, it's happened to your son or your husband or your uncle or most of your neighbors. So you understand, and too many of us don't understand this idea that officers could plant evidence or falsify a probable cause. Why would they do this? So I believe this case, if America is listening, if Baltimore is listening, this case puts our country in the shoes of those who have been silenced for too long.
Catherine Freibalter, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Professor Catherine Freibalter is a former public defender in the Federal District of Maryland.